Boom, and welcome to this podcast for this week. I apologise on the lateness. I recorded the special edition Biden one for the patrons subscribers there, and then I just kept getting to a point. I just kept getting waylaid, sidetracked. I'm reading a book called Under the Banner of Heaven. We're going to talk a bit about religion today, and this is about fundamentalist Mormons that still practice polygamy. Like that TV series Big Love. I think it was called Big Love. My mum really liked it. It was really good. And it goes into the story of Joseph Smith, who was the person who started the Mormon religion. Initially he had these little looking stones, peep stones or seer stones. He saw himself as a seer, as someone who could see into the future. And he bung a stone in a hat, put his head in the hat so that no light could get into the hat. And apparently he could see visions, like luminous, white-coloured stones, dazzled his eyes. And through the peep stone or the seer stone, he could see whereabouts other peep stones or seer stones were buried around the town, kind of like portals or signposts leading to the next thing. That's why he would go. He became a scryer, a diviner, or a crystal gazer, and he initially used that skill to find buried treasure, but then he decided to start his own religion. But there's a funny bit on page 63 where he's talking about. So he found a book made of gold. The pages were made of gold, and it was written in Egyptian script that he couldn't translate. But then they had these special goggles or glasses that he bung on, and then that would help him to translate the script. But then the glasses got taken away by Moroni, the angel, and then he'd have to use his peep stones to translate the rest of the book. Then Joseph took the manuscript to the publisher of a local newspaper called the Wayne Sentinel, and asked him to print and bind 5,000 copies of the book, an uncommonly large printing for a self-published volume by an unknown figure, which indicates that Joseph had giddy expectations for how it would be received. There's a lot of self-publishing going on now, mainly people who, a lot of QAnon people are doing own self-publishing or I've mispronounced this last time. White supremacists, people who have quite outre beliefs outside of mainstream tastes. Though, as we said before on another podcast, the Overton window has shifted, so that fringe concerns have now become part of social discourse, mainstream social discourse. But tried to print this book, the Golden Book, the Book of Mormon, and he intended to charge $1.25 per copy. Not an exorbitant price by any means, but still about twice as much as most local wage earners made in a day. And the skeptical publisher demanded $3,000 up front to print the books, which is a lot more cash than Joseph Smith had. And as was his wont, when confronted with an apparently insurmountable hurdle, he sought divine guidance. And God announced in reply that it was his divine wish that Martin Harris, his mate, Joseph's acolyte and scribe, that God told him conveniently that Martin Harris needs to foot the bill. And God, speaking through Joseph, obviously, told Harris, I command thee that thou shalt not covet thine own property, but impart it freely to the printing. And misery thou shalt receive if thou wilt slight these counsels. Yeah, even the destruction of thyself and property. Pay the printer's debt. It's fucking Martin, who's usually putty in Joseph's hand. But his involvement with the translation had already cost him dearly. Like, his wife had grown so exasperated over his obsession with the Golden Bible that she divorced him. So Harris balked at heeding the commandment when Joseph first presented it to him. In the end, a stern directive from God wasn't something Harris was prepared to ignore, so he reluctantly agreed to sell his farm in order to finance the publication. It's fucking Joseph, man. Martin, God's had a little word with God. A little word, just checking in, see where the lay of the land is. We're speaking of land, we'll get on to that. Had a little chinwag with God. He's saying, I don't get this guy sometimes. He's saying that I have to nibble your wife's tits to reverse global warming. Kind of save the planet after a little nibble on your wife's tits there. So, I mean, who are you to argue with God, Martin? No, I know it's not a nice thought for you. No one wants it to happen, mate, but does anyone want global warming to happen? People more concerned about global warming than me having a nibble on your wife's tits. Who are you to argue with God? I mean, I'm over here nibbling your wife's tits, you fucking cuckold. You're not the kind of strong man who can stand up to God through me. You ever nibble them? Martin's like, no. No, she says her nipples are sacred and thou shalt not enter. Yeah. Especially when I'm having a good old fucking chew on them. I'm chewing your wife's tits for you, Martin. I'm doing this for you. So, Joseph was a bit of a swindler, a bit of a scoundrel. And its sacred touchstone and guiding scripture was the translation of the gold plate, which bore the title The Book of Mormon. No, I've not seen the musical, but I'm sure it's very good. The guys who do South Park are just excellent, as always. I mean, I don't know how dear you hold the tenets of your religion, viewer, listener. If you have a religion, let me know. I wrote this part of my book. You know, I'm a Quaker. I came to Quaker late in life. Had no other Quakers in my family. My dad is a quiet Catholic, a small C Catholic. Didn't realize he was a Catholic until like a couple of years ago. Even though at birth he named me Pope. Which should have been a giveaway. No, he didn't. That's not my real name. But you know that. If you're a real fan, you will know that. What's my national insurance number? What's my bank code? You won't find anything in there, mate. You won't find anything in that old bank. I'm hemorrhaging money all the time because I keep binge buying books to fill some gaping void in my tiny little belly. So in the book, it says, I'm in black. I'm on the way to work to a care shift in the narrative. I'm in black shoes, black trousers, a black long sleeve T-shirt rolled up to the elbows and a black sweatshirt. Fundamentally, I think most comedians are outsider anti-establishment personalities, but petty rather than punk, who'll take any opportunity to assert their independence, even if it means faking a commitment to a Quaker mode of dress to avoid wearing a healthcare tunic, which is exactly what I do. An important touchstone of the faith is plain, unostentatious clothing. Though I have two custom-made jumpers I wear while performing, and in that instance, I'm not worried about observing the tenets of my religion. The first one reads, Indonesian kids are now getting high off boiled sanitary pad water. It's one of my favourite news headlines. I wear it hosting Pope's Addiction Clinic. The second, comedy critic, I'm not going to name the comedy critic, says comedy critic, who the comedy critic is, has a tight foreskin. And this is to troll a comedy critic that I think has a bit of a sexist gender bias. But I don't know if he has a tight foreskin. And it's, he kind of can't get me done for that because I'm not besmirching his character. But there's what I mean, I'm aware that by saying someone has a tight foreskin is sort of infantilizing, because if you had that when you were young, it's something you should have you should have solved. You should have solved your tight foreskin as you came into adulthood. But it's not a fun... There's a specificity as well to it that's funny, but it's also not something that's, you know, it's not a moral stain on your character or anything. How can you ruin someone's reputation by saying they have a tight foreskin? Let's say like a porn star or a knob model. So yeah, it's the plain ostentatious clothing and outward custom to reflect our religious interiority, alongside a commitment to egalitarianism by resisting arbitrary obeisance to authorities. And whenever a regional director or someone from head office asks me why I'm not wearing a tunic, I cite the Freedom of Religion section of the Human Rights Act 1998. I actually do. I don't want to be adorned with corporate logo. I'm trying to strip away worldly paraphernalia and reject the hierarchy of a corporate structure, I said the last time this was questioned. What about the real Real Madrid logo on your rucksack there? Asked the regional director. Excuse me for a moment. I have diarrhea, I responded. I assume I'm being awkward and obstreperous and uncooperative for the sake of it, but this defiance of the status quo can provide a useful function if it's pushing against the business over welfare model of profit extraction. Been disastrous for the care sector, and even the most trivial and petty acts of insubordination can have a positive impact on a work shift. Having said that, I don't want to wear the tunic because it's tight around my love handles. Well, the other carers who I go on to talk about here, she wasn't a very nice carer. And I say she has egg yolk hair pulled back into a messy bun. The closer your vision moves towards her hairline, the darker or greyer the hair becomes, like a cross-section of sedimentary rock, yellow to orange to brown to grey. She also has buck teeth and bulbous eyes. A uniform that's two sizes too small, so it cuts in her torso into chubby segments. Sausage meat wrapped in cling film, as Tina, another carer, once described Sue. Within care home lore, Tina was famous for frantically searching for Gilbert's socks, despite Gilbert having no legs, and despite Tina knowing this because she'd been caring for him for 5 years. I'm going to read a little bit. I've got a weird religious devotion that is something I pray to daily. So when we was in rehab and we were asked by our therapist for our higher what's it called? Higher spirit? No, what's it called? Higher. So in AA. Higher power, that's it. Higher power. God, what is wrong with my brain today? Higher power. When we was asked what our higher power is, like a lot of people, they'll either choose God or their kids. Or one, someone told me the other day, someone picked the bus that gets them to the AA meetings, which I thought was quite nice, quite a sort of pedestrian version of the higher power concept. something quite parochial about it, which is I liked. In my book, there's an anecdote vignette about this sweet corn I found under a hoarder's sofa when I was 4 years old. And when I returned a few years later, it was still there. And even at that young age, I think my granddad was dying at the time, I imbued it with a lot of meaning. And now I imagine it as there's a Flemish philosopher called, and people haven't, they haven't come to a consensus about how to pronounce its name, but his name, but it's spelled GEULINCX. It's Flemish. So, got any Flems in? Got any Flems out there? Any Flems who want to correct me or make a judgment on that? Anyway, so his conception of a faraway god, it was a god that created the universe and then turned away from his creation, who doesn't intervene in any way, much like the corn. But for the grace of Cobb, go I. Come on, little joke. And when I was in rehab, they asked me what my higher power is, and put on the spot, I panicked and I chose that bit of sweet corn. It was like a talisman when my granddad was dying. It meant something. I actually remember thinking it was the root of all cancer, and that if I get rid of it, I'll cure cancer. But I didn't get rid of it because something compelled me to keep it there, because it had been there for so long. It was like pre-dehydrated at this point, but it was in the exact same spot 4 years later. So I attached a divinity to it. So when they asked for my higher power in rehab, I panicked and chose that bit of sweet corn. And my therapist responded, have you got anything other than sweet corn? No. Like, I get to pick my higher power and quibble. There's also a guy in rehab who was about a 72-year-old kind of dapper, natty bloke with a nice sort of decking stained tan. Imagine him to have a plastic pineapple in his house. And he would come back to the rehab as like a success story of someone who got out the other side of drug abuse. And his nickname was Dave the Train, because he tried to kill himself by jumping in front of a train 4 times and survived. Dave the Train, good guy. Took us out for it was our first time we was allowed out the building, other than to go to meetings in the evening, in the daytime, first time we were allowed out. And it's also the first time we were allowed caffeine, and we all had a coffee after like 3 weeks. So it was nice. It was blissful. I've got this book here, William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And I thought, I haven't read it yet, but I thought I'd read a bit here. So this is the lecture known as The Sick Soul. At our last meeting, we considered the healthy-minded temperament. What's healthy, though? Hey, R.D. Lang? Is the madness, is that actually the most rational way of being mad? And the answer is no. No, it's not, because mad people eat poo, don't they? Or mad people jump out in front of trains. Or mad people think the IRA is after them. Or they hold their housemate hostage by sitting outside their door with a cricket bat all night. And every time their housemate tried to emerge, the person would smash the door frame because they were going mad. So no, that's rubbish. The temperament, which I did that. But me and my housemate laugh about it now. It's become part of our shared stock of funny, silly anecdotes, the time I held him hostage for an entire evening. The temperament which has a constitutional incapacity for prolonged suffering, and in which the tendency to see things optimistically is like a water of crystallization which the individual's character is set. We saw how this temperament may become the basis for a peculiar type of religion, a religion in which good, even the good of this world's life, is regarded as the essential thing for a rational being to attend to. I don't think we should only attend to good. It's a very Nietzschean conception of morality, of the moral order of the universe. Donald Trump, weirdly enough, has got that Nietzschean mindset, except everyone's split into winners or losers. And now he's stewing in the dirty bathwater of his loss, the biggest loss of a lifetime, forever stained as a one-term president, unless he runs again in 2024 and gets it. But I think that's unlikely. Donald Trump Jr. might, though. He's kind of galvanizing the base, bringing a bit of a sort of young, vibrant energy to the what was probably the radical wing, the populist wing of the GOP, but now has absorbed it completely because they're fucking spineless little leeches. The religion directs him to settle his scores with the more evil aspects of the universe by systematically declining to lay them to heart or make much of them, by ignoring them in his reflective calculations, or even on occasion by denying outright that they exist. Eight people like that. You always know they're suffering some kind of protracted trauma as well. When you see people, like I used to work with a girl and she's always like, oh, what a wonderful day is outside. And I was like, my God, you're grating. Fuck. You're horrible. Like, shit would be kicking off. I remember someone, idiot, some lanky sort of div kid, brushed a load of baby, little, like, sort of baby hamsters out, like little jelly beans. They were in the sawdust. He didn't realize and was just mindlessly sweeping the sawdust out of the cage into a bin. And I luckily found them wiggling about in there and save them. But yeah, when that was going on, she was just like just sitting there bloody plaiting her hair and laughing like a fucking mad horse. Like people like that, they stuff permeates too much. It cuts too deeply. So they become delusional. God, I hated her. I fucking hated her. She was so annoying to work with. But very, very, very ill. Very damaged person. Evil is a disease. And worry over disease is itself an additional form of disease, which only adds to the original complaint. Even repentance and remorse, affections which come in the character of ministers of good, maybe but sickly and relaxing impulses. The best repentance is to up and act for righteousness and forget that you ever had relations with sin. You can't be lead a morally pure life. You try your best. It's like this idea of a utopic vision. You know you're never going to attain it, but why not move in that direction? But at the same time, you cannot set a moral threshold or expect a sort of moral purity. That's impossible. It's not sustainable. People can't have that sort of level of moral purity, which is why we have real problems on the left. I mean, what are you using as a yardstick? Why are people like self-appointed arbiters or behavior. No, there's behavior we have to call out, of course. But I always think it's better to take an approach of reaching common ground and understanding. And we shouldn't write people off so easily. Like in the book, actually, with that Sue. I'll read it out. We have this exchange. So Sue says, Leslie, I couldn't stand Sue. I really, really hated her. But because I thought she was quite a cruel person. Very self-pitying and just all the worst, most antisocial traits in one person. But she had her moments. And when she went, I had a weird, skewed, kind of warped affection for her. A better the devil you know type of affection or attachment. Leslie, I said, if I had to share a bed with any of them, I'd choose the big pads and catheter lads. We're back in the care team manager's office waiting for the morning handover. There's still empty boxes of chocolate littering the top of the filing cabinets and a mini Christmas tree on Leslie's desk. It's a few days before New Year's Eve. I'll pick little Junie, I reckon, says Leslie, giving it some genuine consideration while leaning back in her desk chair waiting for the late arrivals. Her fingers are slotted together, resting on her stomach. Leslie also rejects the crimson tunics that are meant to be worn by CTMs. She has a navy one issued to her over 15 years ago. She never let it go. Her room always smells lovely. Her boys really make a fuss of her. Make sure it's kept nice in there. That's the way it should be, isn't it, Pope? I was reluctant to get involved, but now I'm part of this. Yeah, probably June or Margaret D, room 19. She's completely compos mentis, so she'll ask to go to the toilet. And I chat to her about visiting Winchester, what's happening with the Tory party. Have like a proper laugh with her, so yeah. Rather her than Billingsgate in room 5, replies Sue, an eager smile forming on her face, a light going on behind the eyes. Why Billingsgate, I ask. Billingsgate fish market. There's a pause. Enough of that. No, I'm not having that. We all like a laugh and jokes, says Leslie. A hint of suppressed amusement in her voice. Sue, with a broad grin and wired eyes, poking my shoulder, hoping I'll be a willing accomplice, says, it's proper Billingsgate, isn't it, though? Don't blame me. I'm the one who has to deal with it. I have a pound of place, but not from down there, thank you very much. Now, this is cruel and demeaning, and I can't show any outward signs of encouragement. There's something about how relentlessly inappropriate Sue is that, despite knocking my moral compass, of course, I get a flicker of enjoyment from. It's something akin to the pathetic genius of teenage boys railing against politesse. And Sue is fundamentally antisocial, rude, brash, histrionic, self-pitying, awful to work with, but she has her moments. I know that later in the day, I'll spend an extra couple of minutes with the lady in room 5 as an act of contrition. And when I see her, small and frail in an oversized chair, fastidiously reorganizing the tissues on her side table, and looking up to give me an "it's all in order" smile as I stand in a doorway, I'll hate Sue. I'll hate Sue for reducing this woman, a childhood spent in the Scottish Highlands, an accent refined by the elocution lessons of teacher training, holidays in Margate, a weekend in St. Ives, all the snippets and fragments of personal history that build a porous image of the person you're caring for, reducing her down to a symptom to be mocked, and how easy it is to do this when you're regularly presented with a tabulation of ailments and examples of faltering selfhood. So, oh yeah. But because my instinct is to undermine sincerity and something, when I'm being sincere, I was going to end that bit and how easy it is to do this when you're regularly presented with a tabulation of ailments or examples of faltering selfhood. I was going to go, but she did have a stinky cunt note. Oh, fuck no. Oh, too harsh. Mustn't call it a CUNT. Apologise. Oh, no. And about a, old lady. I mean, this isn't an actual old lady that exists. These are the kinds. I mean, that actual conversation did play out like that, and we reprimanded Sue. But Sue would kind of lean into it so much that sort of, despite yourself, you found yourself kind of glowing internally, even though you hated what she was doing, and then you kind of hated her for making you knock your moral compass, of course, by finding it a little bit funny. But yeah, I didn't actually laugh. I didn't want to encourage that type of behavior. Sorry about the stinky CUNT. That's awful. I was trying to, we can't all be Jerry Sadowitz. He can get away with it. I can't. I'm not that type of comedian. Sometimes I do bits. The other thing I really like is like the effect that music has on people living with dementia. It's really amazing. Like, it never stops surprising me how transformative it can be. I cared for a 99-year-old who lost all memory of the wife he was married to for 65 years. But if you put a keyboard in front of him, he fucked it like a 21-year-old. Such a beautiful sight. Just got right in there, fucked his keyboard. It's beautiful. It's how it comes back to them. Just fucked it. Fucked it right in the port. Input, output. Gave that keyboard a good rogering. It's lovely when they're like that. I'm going to read from my book, my Quaker book. Social justice and sustainability. That's what drew me to Quakerism, is the social justice part of the fact that it's such a it's such an integral part of being a Quaker. Oh Lord, if it is all the same to thee, give us a little more light and a little less noise. Abraham Lincoln. Perhaps no greater area of consideration in a Quaker's life and practice today exists beyond concern for right action in response to social inequities and injustice. Long a voice for the voiceless and an advocate for the oppressed, Friends have a tradition of seeking to right perceived wrongs and bring light to situations, interpersonal, familial, and societal, that demonstrate imbalances in power and the overlooking or denial of the sacred center, that of God, in everyone. We believe there's an innate godliness within us all. Whenever we feel neighborliness or fellow feeling or compassion, that's God. Sort of metaphysical conception of God. Among friends, action on behalf of social justice arises not from outward pressure for societal change, but from an inward leading, a pressure within that calls, like pressure like diarrhea, that calls friends into right relationship with the issue, needing more light, whether that is racism, oppression, abuse of power, food inequity, the need for restorative justice, exploitation of the planet, or other pressing and worthy contemporary concerns. The process of discerning right action among friends can be varied and laborious. As Quakers individually and corporately seek to discern and find unity on the correct reverential action they feel led to take in response to a particular concern of the day. The important step of discernment and the equally important step of taking action, along with all the deep listening and threshing that occurs along the way, is a vital and time-proven part of Quaker process. From the earliest seeds of Quakerism planted by George Fox in a social soil that was ripe for change, friends have felt compelled to change the world in which they live by seeking to be true to principles of fairness, equality, and right order they found within, taught by Christ, the inward teacher. deep in the energy of George Fox's transformative encounter with the Christ within, outside of Coventry in 1647, was the belief that Christ teaches every heart, and that the inward leadings of the individual Christ-like action and transformation of the outer world follow from this encounter. So yeah, good works. I try and lead my life according to those principles. I come up short a lot. You know, talk about some stinky cunt is not very Quaker. But there's stinky knobs, there's stinky dicks. The body smells. That's the takeaway from this. Sometimes, not all the time. And actually, by acknowledging that, it can lead to politically progressive ends, which is what the book will involve. You know, tolerance and acceptance of the vagaries of aging and ailing bodies. Because when people sanitize that representation and other people are confronted with it, they're not inured to the realities of aging, and they use that as an excuse to look away. And when they look away, that leads to the deprivation and neglect of the elderly in this country and the most vulnerable people, which is why I always vouch for rubbing people's fucking faces in it. Grow up, you're fucking grown up. And look away from your poor relative that's in a nursing home getting themselves in a bit, you know, a bit of it's distressed because they've done some bodily function that they're now trying to hide. Look at it. Look at that bread bag full of shit. And our spirit and body of the Hasidic movement. This is from Hasidism by Martin Buber. Movements which strive for a renewal of society mean mostly by it that the axe should be put to the root of the present order. Rejuvenation. Rejuvenation. Reformed Jew for nation. Which nation is it? Is it England or is it Israel? Your loyalty is divided, my friend. Which one's it going to be? Fucking right-wing idiots. There's a weird sort of coalescence of... Because we know we've got terrible problems with anti-Semitism on the left. And outwardly, Trump has thrown a lot of support behind Jewish self-determination. The same as I believe in the right to Jewish self-determination. But we know that anti-Semitism is also rife on the right wing as well. But is it just that Islamophobia is more pronounced on the right now, that people forget the logical end point of any kind of intolerance against any kind of minority or oppressed groups includes the Jewish people, includes Black people, you know, hate is hate. I mean, there's gradations of hate. Obviously, you hate things. Like I hate Sue from work, but I hate another colleague I used to work with who sexually assaulted me, grabbed and tugged my dick. When you say it like that, like a grab and a yank, it makes it seem like an activity on Funhouse. A whole lot of fun time for everyone. Grab his knob, give it a yank. Oh, fun house. Oh, it trivializes it, but it's something. I mean, I didn't feel threat. I didn't feel any level of threat. I didn't feel threatened because I knew I could fucking have him, mate. I could have him, son. I chinned him with a milk jug, grabbed him by the scruff. Job done. Sorry, I'll get back to the Hasidic book. I could have everyone. I'm not being deluded, but I could probably do anyone in. Big tough guy. Like one of these comedians that call themselves fucking chuckle snipers. Shadow box before they get on stage. Dickheads who I actually like, feel a certain amount of affection for. Not so the religious movements which aim at a renewal of the soul, renewal, rejuvenation, renovation. Be the principle which a true religious movement urges, ever so opposed to the state of religion paramount in the environment. The movement feels and expresses this contradiction not as a contradiction of the really existing original content of tradition, much more does it feel and declare itself as called upon to purify its original content of its present accretions, to restore it, to bring it back. It's like traditionalism or originalism. You get constitutional originalists in the Supreme Court. Who's the one who died? What's he called? He was really Supreme Court Justice Scalia. That's it. Scalia, Anthony Scalia. He was a constitutional originalist. He thought the Constitution wasn't open to interpretation. It was as it was written. And I think you get Salafi Muslims who believe in the edicts of the Quran aren't open to interpretation. You have to be taken very literally. And there was something one preacher said about. So wait, what was it? Wait, Salafi Muslim breastfeeding at work. Something about breastfeeding at work. Feeding at work. I think he was saying like fat talk, adult breastfeeding. He said that if a woman fed a male colleague directly from her breast at least 5 times, they would establish a family bond and thus be allowed to be alone together at work. Breastfeeding an adult puts an end to the problem of the private meeting and does not ban marriage, he ruled. A woman at work can take off the veil or reveal her hair in front of someone whom she has breastfed. So this was Dr. Izzat Atiyah, head of Al-Azhar University's Department of the Hadith. He issued a fatwa or Islamic legal decree saying that the female workers should breastfeed their male co-workers in order to work in each other's company. That's obviously a very extreme stance on the interpretation, the interpretations of the Quran there. But quite funny. Anyway, we'll end on there. Breastfeeding adults at work. We had started on that as well, nibbling tits. But that was in the context of Mormonism. There's fundamentalist Mormons who practice polygamy. And the family tree gets so convoluted that there's this one woman who became her own step-grandmother. Yeah. Anyway, this is the penultimate episode of the series. Got one more bonus episode this Saturday. And final episode of the series next Tuesday. And no more until 2021. Though, if you're a Patreon subscriber, jump on that. just £3 a month you can pay, and you'll get bonus episodes all through that period, and other bonus content. Thank you for listening. I hope you liked it. Love you all. Goodbye.
Down, get on it, horn it. I got myself a bonnet. I'm Quaker, I'm Maker. I lift it up and porridge. Yes, porridge. Yes, porridge. Yes, sacks of chocolate and porridge. Yes, porridge. Yes, porridge. Let's porridge. Boom, boom, boom. We're not just a porridge. We also did nice things. Boom. Give the give the give the boom, 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 boom. Dun, 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 dun. Boom. Dun, 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 dun. Ooh, get on it. I bought myself a bonnet. I'm Quaker. I'm Maker. Sacks of porridge and on it I go to my bonnet. I'm Quaker, gonna make her. We did nice things too. Boom, 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 during the antebellum period, we got slaves from the south to the north in America. Underground railroads, sport gay marriage. Boom, got my bonnet, got my bonnet, got bonnet. Ooh.